Good morning. Oh, I didn't do that right. I'm Sharon Ali, and we are continuing a series on the parables in Matthew. 3A4. I'm doing number 4. And it is the parable of the yeast. So let's just start with some prayer before we flip open our Bibles. Lord, thank you so much for your work in our lives. Thank you for this word that you've given us to ponder. And I pray you would, as we read your words this morning, think about them. I pray that you would convict us, that you would comfort us, that you would show us something new, and that it would have an effect on us the rest of this week, the rest of our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. So it's taken from Matthew 13, verse 31 and 32. I'll read it. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed with 3 measures of flour until all the dough had risen. Nice. I'm going to talk about this one verse for a while. So as we get into this, first we have to think about yeast. And we're going to have to shift back into a more ancient technology. How many of you guys make challah yesterday? Some of you? Before Shabbat? So yesterday I made some challah also. And the way I did it is I used a bread machine. Dump all the ingredients in a machine. Hour and a half later, it has dough for me. I just braid it, let it rise, pop it in the oven, and the whole process takes about 2.5 hours. So pretty good, pretty fast. But it's easy to forget that, I don't know, 150, I don't know exactly when, just a matter of over 100 years ago, nobody made bread this way. There was no such thing as yeast you could buy in the store. And the whole process was very involved and much longer. So there are people today, you can look online, natural bread making, and you can see how to do it. Where does the yeast come from? It comes from the air, there's yeast everywhere, and your hands. Same way when people used to stomp the grapes and some of the yeast on their foot would help, and the yeast on the skin of the grapes is actually what helps the fermentation. So people think the same thing. When you start kneading the dough, the yeast on your hands and the yeast in the air gets in the dough, and over a lot of time, you know, allows it to ferment. Of course, you can also make a starter where you have flour and water, it starts to ferment. You add a little flour every day, and you keep it just the right balance. I understand it's a bit of an art, and Nicole will know. But everyone warns us, it's okay if you don't like sourdough. You can also use a starter to make bread that is not sour. So that's the whole art of it. Anyway, the point is you work it into the dough, and if you're doing it with the natural way, it takes hours and hours. And I guess it also depends on the flour you're using, but I read some places, you know, you have to wait 8 hours, 12 hours, and obviously I'm not an expert in this. But notice that significantly longer, the process takes a long time compared to what we're used to today. So that's just a background on what it means to have leaven at all in the ancient world. Many commentaries, as we read this parable, they're a little bit surprised that Jesus would be using yeast to explain his kingdom. Because after all, isn't yeast normally used in like negative connotations in the Bible? And so I wanted to read a couple of passages in the Bible to see if, to see how we should respond to this image of yeast. So we're going to start in the Hebrew Bible, and then we're going to go back, work back to the New Testament. So depending what word you're going to follow, we got two. There's seor, the leavening, and then there's chametz, which is also leavening but implies a thing made of leavening. Seor only actually comes 5 times in the Bible, Hebrew Bible. And most of those are in the context of Pesach, Passover. So you'll remember it says, for instance, in Exodus 12, 15 to 20, for 7 days you must eat bread made without yeast. So that's matzot. Surely on the first day you must put away yeast from your houses. Tashbitu seor. That's the word seor. Because anyone who eats bread made with yeast, that's chametz, from the first day to the seventh day will be cut off from Israel. So seor is what you work into the dough to make something chametz. And in Pesach, you're supposed to get rid of all of it. And then later on down the same passage, again it says that seor shouldn't even be found in your houses, and anyone who eats machmetzet, again the bread made out of seor, should be cut off from the people. So 5 times, or many times out of the 5, it's referring to Passover. The non-Passover occurrence is in Leviticus 2:11. Every gift or every offering that you bring to the Lord should not be made out of chametz, because all leavening and all honey shouldn't be burned as a fire offering to the Lord. So that's interesting. Again, we have kind of a negative thing, right? Don't bring chametz, or at least don't burn chametz as your offering. However, there is also Numbers 28:7 that details an offering, and for every lamb, you are to pour out a nesech, a libation of shechar. So depending how you translate shechar, I translate that beer, that's something fermented. So it does get a little confusing there. We also have Exodus 23:18 and Exodus 34:25 that tell us, don't sacrifice the blood of my offering on chametz, on this leavened bread. And the priest portion, according to Leviticus 6:10, says don't bake their portion as a leavened bread, because it's coming from my holy burnt offerings, just like the hatat, just like the sin offering, and just like the guilt offering, or just like the purification offering and the guilt offering. And maybe these prohibitions are because they're eating in a holy place, and they want to get rid of the yeast. So when you read these passages, your impression of yeast is something you want to get rid of, right? Something you're not desiring, or we could just say bad. But again, you could think of it ceremonially in the same way. Anyone here heard of Jacob Milgram? Yay! He's a scholar. Jewish scholar who lived in our days, and he tried to explain. He wrote a huge commentary in the book of Leviticus. It's worth reading if you have questions. He tried to explain the system of ceremonially clean and unclean as kind of schematically describing what is death, appears like death, or somehow connected to death and decay. That would be unclean. And what is life, or appears like life, connected to life. And it really explains a lot of things. I kind of like that theory. And if you follow it, you could kind of see yeast as something that leads to decay. So you could kind of see how they would want it separate. It would kind of fall naturally in the unclean side and not the clean side. It breaks things down. But like I said, there are some exceptions where the yeast is not only okay, it's accepted, but it's required. You can look at Leviticus 7:13, where you have, during Shavuot, you bring two leavened breads as this first fruit gift of the new year, the new harvest. And then what? Halot, yeah. And then you have other one. Oh, the Thanksgiving peace offering, which is also leavened bread. And that's okay to eat. It's an offering you can bring, and you eat it. Menachem Sarna says in his book Exploring Exodus, "It's likely that the process of fermentation was associated with decomposition and putrefaction, and so became emblematic of corruption." So he's kind of describing, in better words, what I was trying to say. If you take Milgram's theory of, you know, clean and unclean, it just becomes a natural metaphor for the moral side, corruption, something that's decaying. But if we take a step back, I mean, yeast is neutral, right? It's something good. We normally eat bread made with yeast. It's not Pesach every day. That's 1 week of the year. And, you know, it can be something just normal. So let's go back to the New Testament. With this in our mind, we have a metaphor that can easily lend itself to something negative. And that's exactly how 1 Corinthians 5:16 uses yeast. So if you want to flip there, you can. Sorry, 1 Corinthians 5:6. You don't have to. I'm going to read it to you. But if you want to, you can. "Your boasting is not good. Don't you know that a little yeast affects the whole batch of dough? Clean out the old yeast so that you may be a new batch of dough. You are, in fact, without yeast, for Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. So then, let us celebrate the festival, not with the old yeast, the yeast of vice and evil, but with the bread without yeast, the bread of sincerity and truth." So here the yeast does, in fact, look bad. We want to get rid of the yeast, and we want to be matzah. You want to be unleavened bread. But the reason it looks bad here is because Paul weaves in Passover. The whole metaphor is coming from Passover, where you're not supposed to have yeast. Notice, though, that he also starts with a rhetorical question or a proverb, but I don't want to use the word proverb because that would be confusing with our story proverb. I'm going to use the word aphorism. Is that an okay word with everyone? Aphorism? It's a pithy observation that contains a general truth. Does that help? It's like a short little statement, like, give me one. It takes one to know one. There you go. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. These short little statements that give you a little observation that has a very general truth behind it. Aphorism. Proverb. Again, I didn't want to use proverb because proverb, we're using proverb in the sense of a story proverb, a little story that Jesus tells. And that's different from just saying a little statement out there. So the aphorism I'm talking about here is, don't you know that a little yeast affects the whole batch of dough? And that's how Paul starts in 1 Corinthians 5:6. So you guys immediately hear the connection to our little story proverb back in Matthew. And some people have even said, well, maybe Paul got it from Jesus here. Maybe he's relying on this Matthew passage because they're so similar. Or maybe there was some parable that both people are working off of. But again, this little statement he makes, it could be, we'll just call it neutral. It could be good or bad. depending how you're going to plug it into a greater context. And we even have this exact same little aphorism in Galatians 5:7. And here, you know, Book of Galatians, that's like, it needs a whole explanation. But so in the context of those who were teaching that people who didn't need to be circumcised should be circumcised, it says, "You were running well. Who prevented you from obeying the truth? This persuasion does not come from the one who calls you. A little yeast makes a whole batch of dough rise. I am confident in the Lord that you will accept no other view." So again, he's using this, a little yeast makes a whole batch rise, in a negative context. And notice what the yeast actually is here. This persuasion. There's a teaching going on. And it's a wrong teaching that has influence. And he's confident that in the end, they're not going to accept another view. They're not going to accept this other teaching, this other influence. Because this wrong teaching is going to cause people not to obey the true teaching. So, we have two contexts we looked at in the New Testament where yeast is definitely used in a negative context. And now we're going to go look at Matthew 16, verse 5 to 12. I'll read that for you. "When the disciples went to the other side, they forgot to take bread. 'Watch out,' Jesus said to them, 'beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees.' So they began to discuss this among themselves, saying, 'It is because we brought no bread.' When Jesus learned of this, he said, 'You who have such little faith, why are you arguing among yourselves about having no bread? Do you still not understand? Don't you remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up? With the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many baskets you took up? How could you not understand that I was not speaking to you about bread? But beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees.' Then they understood that he had not told them to be on guard against the yeast in bread, but against the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees." So verse 12 explicitly tells us what this yeast is. It's teaching. And we know from the call to beware that it's teaching that we don't want to follow. Now, if you've been here a while and you've studied the teaching of Pharisees and you've studied the teaching of Jesus, you may say, well, hey, actually, Jesus lines up a lot with the teaching of the Pharisees. And you're right. He does agree with a lot of their teaching. But he doesn't agree with how they practice their teaching. So I think that's good to keep in our mind as we hear this teaching of the Pharisees. You look back in Matthew chapter 3:7. There it's John the Baptist talking. But he tells people, he tells the Pharisees, you know the part, "Woe to you, vipers, brood of vipers." Maybe I need to read that one for us too. Matthew 3:7. "When he saw Pharisees and Sadducees coming to his baptism, he said to them, 'You offspring of vipers, who warned you to flee from the coming wrath? Therefore, produce fruit that proves your repentance, or that's worthy of repentance. And don't think you can say to yourselves, we have Abram as our father. For I tell you that God can raise up children from Abram from these stones. Even now the axe is laid at the root of the trees, and every tree that does not produce good fruit will be cut down and thrown into the fire.'" So here the problem is that they're coming to the baptism to be baptized, but John's saying what really matters is a change of heart that will lead to a change of action, Like, you can see by what you do whether you have true repentance. So, that's following Matthew's train of thought of this, the idea of yeast being teaching, and teaching in the sense of halakha. How do you actually live out your teaching? Not teaching in the sense of sitting down and talking about what you believe. Now, Luke, in chapter 12:1, gives us the same phrase from Jesus' mouth, and he makes it very explicit what this yeast of the Pharisees is. I'll just read it for you quickly. Meanwhile, when many thousands of the crowd had gathered so that they were trampling on one another, Jesus began to speak first to his disciples. Be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Nothing is hidden that will not be revealed, and nothing is secret that will not be made known. So then, whatever you have said in the dark will be heard in the light, and whatever you have whispered in private rooms will be proclaimed from the housetops. So Luke is telling us explicitly that the problem here is hypocrisy. Again, it's not what the Pharisees are literally saying. It's their whole attitude, and that the fact that they're not living it out from a place of true, sincere obedience. There's an element of hypocrisy there, and that's the problem. Okay, so the metaphor with yeast in Jesus' day outside of Jesus and Paul, even in rabbinic Judaism, Greek literature, it was being used elsewhere. And you'll have to do your own study there. Also, and when you read other contexts, you see that a lot of people can use the same yeast negatively. So we come back to our first question. Should we be surprised that yeast here is symbolizing the kingdom? And maybe yes. It is a bit of a surprise if you're used to it being negative. However, it embodies a message that, I mean, it's caught your ear like, oh, wait. What is it about yeast that I'm supposed to take away that describes the kingdom? And the whole beauty of a story parable is that it helps you understand some point better than if you just get an abstract explanation. So in a sense, it's really ironic I'm even talking about this, because a parable itself is powerful. And immediately after this parable in the Matthew text, it says that Jesus never taught without a parable. That's amazing, because he wanted people to really get what he was saying. People remember stories better than they remember theoretical treatises. That's just the way we're wired. So when we hear this parable, we have this image that we take away with, we remember, and it's got a main point, and that's what we're trying to get after. But there are also details in this parable. We don't want to press every detail because that would be misusing the parable. But there are details there that are going to be in the audience's background, and they're going to influence how we get that main point. And so I want to go back to the Matthew parable we started reading and think about these details. Wait, I'm going to lose my place here. Okay. We read that a woman hides leaven in 3 sata of flour. A saton is equivalent to se'im, a se'ah. These are all old measurements, right? And when you just read them, most of us, it doesn't have any meaning because we no longer use these measurements. If someone said cups of flour or if someone said kilos of flour, it would make more sense to us. But it just turns out that I have recently taught a course on Abraham. We've been reading through Abraham's stories. And so as I was reading three Se'im, I just immediately thought, oh, that's Sarah. That's Sarah in Genesis 18:6. So, to remind you of what's in Genesis 18:6, it's a story of the angels or people who come to Abraham, and he extravagantly provides a dinner for them. And the end of the story culminates in this promise of this special son that's going to be born. Sorry, I have the wrong. So in Genesis 18:6, so Abram hurried into the tent and said to Sarah, quick, take three measures of fine flour, knead it, and make bread. So, okay, three se'im, that goes back to Sarah. How much would that be? And it kind of depends who you ask, but I'm just going to go with one calculation that says it's about 17 kilos. Okay, how much bread can you make with 17 kilos? Well, a lot? Oh, I heard halot. For a halot, I would say about 34. I'm thinking about, a kilo. You can make two big loaves of bread with 1 kilo of flour. That's a lot of bread. If you were doing pitot, maybe 20 pitot a kilo, that would be like 340 pitot. That's a lot of bread. Certainly way more than is needed to feed three visitors. In fact, it might be enough for 100 people to eat. So this lady working in the leavening is making a ton of bread. And it's interesting to me because in the parable of the sower, that if you think back to Gary's sermon, we talked about the 100-fold, the 100 times produce of the one seed, and how that's a miraculous blessing. And that is a link to Genesis 26, where Isaac is in Gerar, he stays in the land, and God miraculously blesses him. So maybe Jesus, by using three se'im, or sata, which are se'im, is in fact thinking of the Sarah story. And that might give us a little connotation of this parable, that there's something huge going on here. And maybe even that there's something miraculous going on. In the sense of, if you remember the Sarah story and the promise of a son that's going to be born to someone, people too old to have a son. But if you want to say that's going too far, you can. In either case, there is both points of using those measurements shows us how big an amount this is. This is exceptional and extravagant. Oh, and I will also mention the mustard seed that Steve Notley preached on a couple weeks ago. That also linked to Ezekiel. So in each of these parables, there is actually a subtle biblical allusion, if you see it. And so there is room to say that that could color the way you hear it. So we have an extravagant, exaggeratedly large amount of flour. Definitely more than a normal household would be baking at one time. So in the Sarah story, it shows her exceptional generosity and strong arms, yeah. Especially if she's supposed to hurry and knead this all in. Wow, I have trouble just kneading one challah. But this extravagance, this bigness, starting from something small, going to something big, that also links us back to the previous parable. We have the smallest seed, the mustard seed, that becomes the biggest tree. And that's connected to a cedar. What? It's miraculous. And it's an interesting little detail. If you remember back to the passages we read of Corinthians and Galatians, they even add a little yeast leavens the whole lump. In our parable, Matthew doesn't say a little, but by the fact that it leavens such a large amount, it's amazing that just this regular yeast, this little bit you put in, can leaven all of it. So we have a seed that produces 100-fold. We have a mustard seed that miraculously becomes a cedar, the tallest, strongest tree. And then you get this yeast that produces this banquet full of bread. So there's definitely, as I read through these parables, I'm struck with this little crimson thread of something divine, something miraculous. And in a sense, God is working with us. We offer our little nothing, and somehow it's transformed. It becomes something different and something amazing, and it gives a produce that is way beyond what it would normally naturally have given. The natural changes supernaturally. And then there's this hidden element. Did you hear that in the parable? She hides yeast in the dough. Interesting. Why does he say hide? I don't hide yeast in dough. I need it. You know, I put it. Just choosing that word also reminds you of a seed hidden or buried in the ground. It can even remind you of the wheat and tares. In all of these, the working out of this miracle is not readily apparent. You don't see it. You don't notice it at first. The influence is very subtle. So there is a miraculous transformation happening, and it's going to influence everything, but you don't see it. And it takes a lot of time. So if we just go back and listen to this parable of the yeast with ears of Jesus' audience, they don't understand everything about Jesus' mission yet. He hasn't died yet. They don't have the benefit we do of looking backwards and everything seems so simple. And most of them are expecting Jesus to, at some point, get into politics. You know, at some point, become a literal leader and ruler and bring peace to the world. And in fact, today, I've had so many friends, you know, outside of our belief who come and say, well, if Jesus were the Messiah, where's the peace? Where's the stuff that Messiah is supposed to bring about? And it's this parable you have to give them. It's yeast. Jesus is trying to tell people it's not what they're expecting. It's not going to be obvious. Like if he just took up political rule, it would be obvious. His kingdom is something different. It's covert. I would say clandestine, although it's negatively connotated, but I guess so is yeast, so I can. It's behind the scenes. It completely transforms everyone. It transforms their character, their lives. This is God's kingdom. And it starts by a miraculous work in us of his salvation. So what is our takeaway from this parable? What can we get from it? For one, we can remember that God's work is not always obvious in our life or in the life of others. That moment of our salvation, of our accepting God's rule in our lives, his kingdom yeast is hidden in us. It's put in us. And it starts working on our character to make us more like God. So we look around at each other, his followers, and sometimes we don't see a nice fluffy bread. Because it takes time. Lots of time. In Exodus, we remember they ate matzot because they didn't have enough time to wait for it to rise. We have to wait. We have to take time for the bread to rise. It's a process. And I think that this is encouraging to us both on the micro sense and the macro sense. The process of God working in his good yeast into us personally, takes a lot of time. It takes every bit of our whole life and then some. That's a long time, hopefully, if we want a long life. And like I mentioned earlier, this reminds us of the wheat and the fake wheat, or the wheat and the tares. You don't actually even see the true character until they're totally matured, until harvest. Or you could say until our death. You could even say after our death, when we're changed in a twinkling of an eye. So it's encouraging because even though we don't see it, it's there constantly working on us. That's the micro aspect, this confidence in God's work being completed in us. And the macro scope, his kingdom spreading on earth, takes time. All of his disciples through history have been entrusted to spread his message, both by proclaiming it and by living it. And this is definitely still in process, just like we are still in process. And maybe because we are still in process, we mess things up. What is like the one thing outsiders of the faith criticize Christians for? Or I could say believers in Jesus. Hypocrisy. There you go, back to yeast. Even though it's really ironic because everyone is hypocritical. Lawyers are hypocritical. Shopkeepers are hypocritical. Absolutely everyone. So the real problem is that they expect more of Christians. But that's where we give the message. We are the only ones that can be completely honest. We actually can say when we mess up completely because we're grounded on God's faith. We don't have to live in denial like the rest of the world. We don't have to be hypocrites like the rest of the world. We can just say, yeah, I completely mess up. But it's not just me. It's God working in me that matters. So back to this macro process. The yeast of God's kingdom is still transforming the earth. It's still a process, and it's going to take time. We're not there yet. And yet this kingdom yeast has powerful influence. Each of us have powerful influence if we have his yeast in us. If you were to switch metaphors and borrow from C.S. Lewis, he talks about catching the good infection. So if you catch an infection, it's incubating, you will eventually see the symptoms. And here's the good news. If you put us next to other people, we spread it. We spread the infection. Just like yeast, when God is doing his hidden secret work in our life and we're with other people, it's going to spread, even when we don't see it. Or it's so long that we don't see it in process. We can maybe see it in points looking back or at the end of our lives. I don't know. So your little actions have a major influence, a major effect in the big scale of things. Or you could borrow another metaphor from chaos theory, the butterfly wings. A butterfly flaps his wings in the Philippines, and eventually there'll be a storm in Greenland or something like that. Our little actions have huge consequences. So take it all back to Matthew. We have this yeast, this kingdom teaching in our lives and practicing that teaching, obeying that teaching. And God is working that into us more and more. And that is what we're spreading, even when we don't realize it. How does Jesus say we should act? It's not just what we think or believe. Or if you flip it around, based on how you live, other people can see what you really think and believe. If you really believe that food heated in plastic will leach chemicals into it that causes cancer, you won't put plastic containers in microwaves, right? If you don't fully believe this, or if somehow you live in denial, like me, you will heat food in plastic. It's that simple. Little acts of obedience to God's Spirit will have impact on our character and that of all those around us. What we really believe will be lived out, and people are going to see it. So let's let God knead his character into us. Let's have grace for each other, remembering that it takes a long time to see any rising in the dough if you're doing it the natural way. And let's pass on the yeast. Live out your life with God as your king, and you will have influence on those around you. God's work is hidden, it's covert, but it's powerful. It's generous and it's extravagant. His kingdom will come in us and in the world. So we can let that word leaven in your heart.